Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we find out about a new club devoted to napping at Indiana University South Bend. We learn about scam baiters, a group of people who are fighting back against online scammers. We visit a Transformers convention, and we have a conversation with Craig Brewer, writer-director of the new movie Black Snake Moan. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Autobots, Decepticons, Maximals, and Predacons gathered in Lexington, Kentucky last November to celebrate all things Transformers. Chris Caligari was there and has this story.
Favorite Transformer?
I'll do least favorite Transformers, and I didn't even really realize that until I started packing all this stuff up. Headmaster Horrorcons. There's been something about them over the years that's just annoyed the crap out of me. I don't know why.
That's John Hartman, who along with his brother Carl is a legend in these parts. And a Headmaster Horrorcon might be an obscure reference anywhere else in the world except here, at the 12th annual Transformers BotCon convention in Lexington, Kentucky.
So, that's my answer to that question.
Transformers is the name of a line of shape-changing action figures by American toy and game company Hasbro. Launched in 1984, the toy line was promoted through a comic book by Marvel Comics and an animated television series produced by Sunbow Productions. The original Transformers storyline, or Generation 1, revolves around two warring factions of giant transforming robots battling for control of their home planet Cybertron. They consist of the heroic Autobots led by Optimus Prime and their evil counterparts, the Decepticons, led by Megatron. The name BotCon derives from both Robot Convention and the names Autobot and Decepticon. The first BotCon was held in Fort Wayne, Indiana in 1994. It was organized by brothers John and Carl Hartman. Carl says he and his brother came up with the idea for the convention in their bedroom at their parents' house.
It was back in 93, and we knew that the 10th anniversary of Transformers were coming up the next summer. And nothing really was going on with it. The toy line was just kind of sitting there. I mean, they had just come out with the toys after discontinuing the line. But there wasn't any real... We were sure there wasn't going to be any official kind of
recognition
of the 10th anniversary. So we decided to maybe throw some ideas around, maybe hold a show. Have some dealers, have some maybe people from Hasbro come in. You know, bouncing around some ideas of what people might like to see at a show. And just kind of started from there. I mean, it was very small, very, very small at the beginning.
Over the next couple of years, BotCon's organizers and locations varied. In 1997, the Hartman brothers and their friend Glenn Hallett formed 3H Enterprises. Carl says the trio found great success over the next several years, taking the convention to New York and California. However, by 2002, John says 3H's relationship had soured, leaving Hallett as the sole official organizer.
The last show that we had done with Glenn was in 2002. 2003 he did on his own. 2004 we did together and Glenn did his own as the official licensed one. We just did it as more of a fan event. And then in 2004 Brian got the license for doing the show. And then we sold our rights to the name of the show to him, so he became, you know, the sole person doing it.
Enter Brian Savage, director of the Hasbro Transformers Collectors Club. Savage says Hasbro granted him the convention and fan club licenses for Transformers, mostly because of his involvement in another Hasbro toy line, G.I. Joe. Savage says BotCon offers more than just memorabilia for fans. He says it acts as a giant group hug for people who love Transformers.
They come in all ages, shapes, and form, and first of all, they come for the people. They come because they get to share their passion with other collectors and fans that are here. They come for the special guests. They come for we've done some game nights. We have contests. There are diorama. There are 3D figure contests. There are art contests. There's, I think, a couple hundred entries in the contest. So these are all things that people have drawn or customized, or it's their hobby, and that's what people love to spend their spare time. You know, people, that's why it's a hobby, and they come to just celebrate that whole thing.
So you having a good time, Brandon?
Yeah.
Are you a big Transformers fan?
A little bit.
A little bit? What about your dad? Is he a big fan?
Yeah.
How big of a fan?
A really big fan. He has thousands of Transformers.
Meet Mike and his 4-year-old son, Brandon. The father-son duo traveled from Indiana for this year's event. Mike says he was around Brandon's age when he got his first Transformers toy, and the highlight of this trip was finding his son a Generation 1 Soundwave figure. Mike says he's happy he can share his passion for Transformers with his son. As a matter of fact, he says, it's become a family affair.
I got a little girl, too, who is 3 years old. I got pictures of him at home sitting in front of the TV with just watching Transformers on the TV, and it's something that's great because I can feel like a child again while they're feeling, you know, what I felt at that age. So it's a phenomenal feeling.
So what's the appeal of Transformers? Who better to ask than
Optimus Prime Peter Cullen.
Peter Cullen is a voice actor who studied at the National Theatre School of Canada. He's provided voices for such memorable characters as Eeyore from Disney's Winnie the Pooh, and Carr from the science fiction television series Knight Rider. However, of all the characters he's given voices to, Cullen says Optimus Prime is his favorite. He says the appeal of the Transformers lies in the character's values.
From what I've been able to interpret over the last several years is the strength of a hero in relationships and in difficulties with other characters. The Optimus Prime character and others show, you know, integrity and courage and honor and an understanding of some kind that affects, and it used to affect and will again, the lives of a lot of people. They've maintained that feeling years later, and here we are.
As this year's convention winds down, talk turns to BotCon 2007, which is being held in Providence, Rhode Island, Hasbro's home city. It comes the weekend before Michael Bay and Steven Spielberg's live-action Transformers movie is released on July 4th. And it's worth noting that Peter Cullen is reprising his role of Optimus Prime for the film. In Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Chris Caligari.
This is Sidetrack. You get them in your email inbox every day. Spam messages from people claiming to be the relatives of deposed African leaders who need your help in getting millions of dollars out of their country. This is the basic story for the well-known Nigerian 419 scam. Within the last few years, a group of people have started to fight back against these scammers. They call themselves scam baiters. They write back to the scammers to string them along and to hopefully waste the scammers' time. Eve Edelson runs a website called Scamorama and has recently written a book by the same name that collects the correspondences between the scammers and the scam baiters. I recently talked with her and asked her first to explain in detail what the scam is.
Well, the kind of email that people tend to get, the one offering you basically a lot of money in return for helping to move a lot of money, is an example of the 419 scam. And this gets its name from Section 419 of the Nigerian Criminal Code, because at this time in our history, most of the scams of that sort happen to be coming out of Nigeria or elsewhere in West Africa. And the basic model for this crime is very old. I can trace it back at least as far as 19th century France. But it's an example of advance fee fraud. Means that your conman is sending a little bit or possibly a lot of money in exchange for helping to transfer what is actually an imaginary sum. It may be an inheritance you think you have, or a lottery you didn't know you entered, or a relative you didn't know you had who died in a car accident, something like that.
And everybody gets these every day in their email inbox.
Yes.
At least one of these.
It's a significant proportion of the spam in the world.
So this thing is huge all around the world.
It's huge, and it also relies on postal mail. In 2005, the Spanish police arrested a gang of Nigerian expatriates who were making, they estimated, $6 million a year doing this, and they were mostly using the post.
Now,
and probably using forged posts.
Now, as big as this is, as widely known as this scam is, people are still falling for it.
Well, you know what? Maybe it was Barnum who said a sucker is born every minute. It's sad. The scam is packaged in different ways. It may be a thinly disguised appeal to greed, like when they ask you to help embezzle a bank account or a government contract, or it may try to engage your feelings of chivalry, or it may take advantage of your naivete. If you get an appeal from an orphanage in a refugee camp, which somehow has broadband, and wants help in retrieving his father's treasure, it may make you feel you're helping somebody.
And a lot of people, no matter what their position in society, have been taken in by this.
I've heard from a number of victims, and I cannot find any pattern. I can't age, nationality, religion, profession, gender. I can't find anything that's a surefire guarantee of who falls for it. What would be more interesting, and what I'm so much sure about, is how to profile somebody who would never fall for it.
Well, let's move on toward what you are doing and what a group of people are doing called scam baiting. And why don't you explain how that works?
Scam baiting is the art of writing back to a scammer, basically to waste his time and wind him up, as the British say. It's you write back, you pretend to be interested in the offer, and you string the correspondence out as long as you can on one pretext or another, and the scam baiter will go along with it quite a ways, as long as he thinks there's money in the offing, and he hopes for the big score, but instead the correspondence winds up on a website, sometimes accompanied by trophies. And a trophy may mean that you get him to send a picture of himself. It's usually not really him. It's usually probably some guy he pulls in off the street to hold a silly sign. You may get him to show up at the airport at an inconvenient hour, hoping that you're going to show up so that he can meet you and scam you or maybe mug you or kidnap you. There have been all kinds of trophies. One guy in Montreal who posed as Bart Simpson got a scammer to send him $5 as a token of his sincerity. And it just gets more outrageous. I think the most outrageous anti-scam I've heard of yet is on YouTube. There's a guy named Shiver Me Timbers, that's his nom de scam. And he got a scammer to audition for a film with the skit from Monty Python, the Dead Parrot skit. So
wow.
It's a video on YouTube of these two Nigerian guys with a birdcage acting out the Dead Parrot skit in hopes that they're going to get this guy to send him money.
That's amazing. Actually, I've read several of those from the guy named Shiver Me Timbers, and he always gets these scammers to do the most outrageous things. I think he got one of them to transcribe the first Harry Potter book by hand, yeah. Word for word, page for page.
Well, I'm sure it helped his penmanship. It's just beautiful. What I think is most funny changes day to day. I'm kind of in love with the guy who got a scammer to apply for a grant to Miskatonic University to go ghost hunting. And that can be found on Scamorama. It depends on your sense of humor.
And this is kind of what you guys are doing. I think what I'm understanding is it's a twofold thing. You know, one of the missions from Scambaiters is to keep these guys occupied, so in hopes that you're wasting all their time so they won't have time to bother other people.
Yes, there is a serious side to it.
And then the other side is you're getting some humor at their expense.
Yes, although I'm not convinced that there aren't scammers out there who know exactly what's going on and they're enjoying the interplay, but few people agree with me.
But, you know, from what I read from these interchanges, which are up on your website, they're just laden with in-jokes and pop culture references that would probably be lost on somebody somebody in Africa would probably not understand all the in-jokes.
Somebody who hadn't wasted his youth watching American TV shows, obviously. But the scammers are satirizing, too. If you read their letters, you'll see that they're posing as politicians whom they probably accurately assume are corrupt. When they pretend to be the widow of General Abacha, they say he died in service to his country. It's widely rumored that he died in bed with some prostitutes. And he's thought to have stolen like $5 billion from the country over the years. So their letters are full of satire as well. Oh, their latest thing is pretending to be the widows of Yugoslav war criminals.
So it doesn't matter. They'll just pick up something that's somewhat topical to try to hook you
up. Yeah, right after the tsunami, they started sending out tsunami victim letters.
So how did this phenomena of scam baiting start?
I don't know who the first person was. I know that about 7 years ago, when I started putting these letters on my website, basically to warn my friends, I began to receive these correspondences from people all over the world. I mean, from everywhere, from Argentina to Turkey, saying, yeah, I actually write back to these guys. I didn't know anybody else was doing it. Here's an example. Please post it. And so I started doing it. This kind of thing has probably been going on since the dawn of time, just like the scam.
Well, it seems to be a very organic thing that just sort of...
How do you mean?
Well, it just sort of appeared. You know, there was no sort of instruction booklet on, like, this is what you do to bait a scammer. It just sort of, people, I guess, felt this need, this grassroots need to deal with these, and it's just appeared and taken on this form.
Yeah, it's sort of taken on a life of its own. People have very wacky instincts. There are actually now lists of pointers that you can go to if you're interested in getting into that. There's one on Scamorama. Other sites have them, too. And they list basic techniques you can think of to first of all, find a scammer to correspond with if you haven't been lucky enough to receive some spam yourself, and then how to string it out afterwards. It's not the healthiest hobby in the world, I have to say, but it seems to be a huge creative outlet for a lot of people.
Well, it is actually kind of dangerous because you're dealing with criminals who have been known to kill people over this scam.
Yeah, I've heard of people getting killed when they went to Africa to try and get their money back. Big mistake, don't try it.
So what are the pointers? I mean, for those who want to take on these scammers, what should they do and what should they watch out for? And, you know, again, this is not for everybody.
Absolutely.
But
I admit, it's tweaked, and I'm basically a curator. And also, my site pretty much features people whose work I find funny, and I have my own sense of taste, and other people who run other sites have their own. I would say to begin with, you can check the pointers page on Scamorama, and the points consist chiefly of this. Get an email address that's disposable. Anonymize your email if you can. That is, go through proxies if you can. Don't give out any personal details about yourself. Don't go anywhere to meet these guys. Learn how to read an email header. And if you suspect you're dealing with someone in your own country, then you should probably go to the police, and you shouldn't be scambaiting them. But most of these guys are actually sitting in cafes in West Africa. And there's some people are making an awful lot of money out of it, but I think most of them are hobbyists, and some are actually employed maybe in cafes that these scammers run or control in West Africa. And there are a lot of them, and if they get a bite, then they often hand it over to a closer, essentially, somebody who might be overseas in Amsterdam or London or New York or Houston or Chicago. So often these guys are in gangs. Another thing is you can go to websites like 419 Eater, which is actually run by Shiver New Timbers, and get some pointers there. And Stamorama links to a number of boards where you can trade advice. It's a good thing to get advice from other people before you get into it.
Well, what is the motivation, I guess, for you to run a website like this and to, in a way, encourage people to do this?
Well, it's as you said, it's kind of organic. I didn't start with a sense of mission. Basically, I write other things. I write plays and novels, and I didn't really envision putting much time into this, but I began to see it as a form of literature, and I'm interested in it psychologically. And also people, to my astonishment, are still writing for advice and asking, am I being scammed? They don't seem to absorb the basic idea. And so I think I might actually be doing some good, and so for that reason, also, I go on with it. I don't know if I'll do it forever, and I would say, if you're scam baiting and you begin to feel uneasy or bored or you're just not having fun, you should just stop. You should just cut it off right in mid-correspondence.
Well, I find it interesting where you brought up this point where you see it as literature. It's almost like a found art literature.
Absolutely. There's the guy who founded, I think it's called the Sûreté. I guess it's the French equivalent of the FBI in France. He was a very interesting character named Eugène François Vidocq, and he wrote his memoirs in the 1830s and 40s. And he was an ex-con and a police informant who rose to become something of a fixture in the French police. And he, in his memoirs, he describes a letter that was being sent to people of known royalist sympathies. And the letter said, basically, I was the servant of a French aristocrat. My master was condemned by the revolution. I know where he hid his treasure. And if only I had a little money, I could mount an expedition and go retrieve it. Now, does that sound familiar?
Absolutely.
So yeah, it seems like literature to me, and it's amusing, although it is a very serious thing. It's not at all funny if you've been scammed. And I do have some advice on the website for people who think that they've been scammed. But really, it's better to just not be scammed in the first place. The best spam filter is in your head.
Now, you've actually taken some of the correspondence from the website and put them into a book.
Yeah, I was approached by the Disinformation Company. It's a publishing company, and they wanted to use one of the graphics from the website, and they said, and by the way, have you thought of doing a book? The book is sort of 50% serious and 50% fun. Half of it is chapters describing pretty much what we've talked about, the extent of the scam and how to trace an email and how to get into scam baiting. And then each chapter is sandwiched with humorous correspondence, and that's sort of dessert. If you get through the serious chapter, then you get the dessert.
Now, at any point, do you feel sorry for the scammers? When you're asking them to make a movie, or you're asking them to do this, do you ever feel sorry? Do you ever feel that you've gone too far? And I'm not just saying you, but I'm guessing the whole scam baiting community.
I just curate the stuff. No, I don't. I feel sorry for people who are in the general social situation that people in Nigeria seem to be in at the moment. They seem to have been blind by their government for the last 40 years. And of course, money and family connections never hurt anywhere, but it seems like your ethnic status in Nigeria and the amount of money you have are just completely determinant of your lot in life. So a lot of people who graduate high school, it seems like they walk out onto the street, they can't get a job, and then some oga or boss comes up to them and says, hey kid, you want to make money? Are you good with the computer? And I can see why people would get involved in it, but it doesn't mean I feel sorry for them, because they are quite happy to rob people of their last penny.
Now, how do law enforcement agencies feel about scam baiters? I know what they feel about the scammers themselves, but how do they feel about this group of people who are egging them on?
Depends who you talk to. I actually know quite a lot of people in law enforcement. They don't always want to talk about it. I think some of them feel sort of that it's fun. I mean, they can't really condone it, but they think it's kind of a hoot. Some of them will openly cooperate with scam baiters. There was a website that was set up supposedly by a South African detective, Ryan Visser, which has since become, I think, a private venture. But the South African police do link to it, and they try to coordinate the activities of what I guess they would call a more law-abiding sort of scam baiter. There's a line, I think, and again, I'm not a lawyer, and I can't give legal advice, but I think You can go a certain ways before you're actually crossing the line of illegality. And I won't say what that is, but a lot of police think this is funny. A lot of them may not.
For those who are interested in searching out these scambaiter correspondences and to learn more about this community of scambaiters, your website, I guess, is a good resource. What else is there?
Yeah, there's mine. It's www.scamorama.com. And it has links to some boards, some bulletin boards for people who do this, such as 419 Eater and the Anti-Scammer Message Board. Those are the two that seem to be the most long-lived. And they exchange spare email addresses of scammers. They sometimes coordinate their efforts on several continents. They sometimes exchange tools. And also, there's a great site called Artists Against 419, www.aa419.org. Those are the three I would recommend most highly. And then I also link to people who just sort of work on their own and put up their own material. And again, I tend toward humor. There are some anti-scam sites that are more raw, you might say, and some that are kind of racist, and although I would say most of them are completely not.
And, of course, your book is out, too, and can that be found everywhere?
I certainly hope so. It's been known to be stocked at Barnes & Noble and other bookstores. It can also be ordered from Amazon and other online sources, and there's a link to Amazon from the Scamorama website.
That's Eve Edelson. She runs a website called Scamorama. She's also just written a book by the same name featuring letters between scammers and scam baiters. Still to come on the program, a conversation with Craig Brewer, writer-director of Black Snake Moan, and we find out about the Nap Club. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. The United States entered World War II in December of 1941. It was a total war. Everyone got involved, including artists. Independent producer Sarah Elzis has the story about a group of artists who did their part for the war.
In 1942, a group of 20 Broadway stage designers decided they wanted to put their artistic talents to work in the Army. They founded the Camouflage Society of Professional Stage Designers.
They thought that maybe learning about camouflage might help prepare them better.
Ron Naverson is a set designer who teaches at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. He researched the society for a dissertation he wrote in the late 80s.
They hired a Russian army captain, Baron Nicholas Cherkasov, to train them in the basic principles of camouflage. They would build models and things like that.
After 4 months of classes, they went to the recruitment centers to volunteer.
I dreaded going to the Army. This is why I joined the Camouflage Society. If I'm going to go to the Army, I might as well do something behind the lines.
Sam Lev was a young member of the society who had already worked with Orson Welles on Julius Caesar by the time he joined. Ron Naverson interviewed him at his home in 1988. When it came time to sign up for the Army, Lev says he got sick.
104 fever, terrible, terrible, you know? So the Army sent down Army doctors to investigate. Psychosomatic. They put me into 4F. They don't want me in the army, a crazy guy like me.
I only know of three people who definitely served, and that was probably the three most successful designers of their day, Joe Milziner, Donald Owen Slager, and Harry Horner.
I was then in the army. There were three designers, maybe, and they worked on realization of these dreams, so to say.
Harry Horner was designing musicals like Lady in the Dark and Stars and Garters. When he entered the military and went into camouflage as a sergeant, he conceived of the idea of doing a musical review.
The show, called You Bet Your Life, told the history of camouflage. Horner wanted to entertain the soldiers in the audience, but also teach them about the importance of camouflage.
I wanted to get the ordinary foot soldier to find himself a little bit part of this.
None of the music has survived, but the final lyrics are kind of funny. It's so confusing, but so amusing. The ruses one uses are nature's own scheme. Though we're like mirages, we're all camouflages. Things are not what they seem. No, things are never quite what they seem.
There are two basics of camouflage. You can try to make something disappear into its background by working with textures and colors.
And that's, I think, what we think of as camouflage. The other kind of camouflage is to simply make something important look unimportant.
That's what stage designers do all the time.
We're constantly exploring different materials to make them seem like something else. George Dysel was a young theater artist, was not a member of the Camouflage Society. He was a corporal in the 603 Phantom Army.
The 603rd Engineer Camouflage Battalion was part of a division created by the War Department in 1944. It was made up of set designers, actors, and composers. Their job was to use camouflage techniques to deceive the Germans.
You have nice lunches on me.
Ron Naverson interviewed George Dysel in a restaurant in Los Angeles.
I'll tell you what, I always get their onion soup, but that's me.
I asked George Dysel what he told his kids when they asked what he did during the war. And he said, I tell them I blew up tanks.
If you put them up with compressors, you maintain them by a hand pump.
These are just balloons that the Phantom Army would take into town at night, blow them up, inflate them. They would use wire recorders and make a lot of noise. Then they would march through the town on one end and then come back in again so 100 men could look like 1,000 men. The trouble with camouflage is you really never know if it works because you just simply don't get bombed. You only know if it doesn't work.
The other trouble with camouflage, at least for some of these artists, is that they were making art for war.
The fact that these dreams were for a rather nightmarish reality was only part of the dream.
I think it was a very practical necessity. It was the way in which these designers found they could utilize their art skills to serve their country.
That story from Sarah Elzis. You're listening to Sidetrack. If you stop by Indiana University South Bend and see students napping, don't worry. They're probably members of the Nap Club. Yes, a student club devoted to midday naps. The group was founded by students Joe Spencer and Michael Duttlinger. I talked to the two of them recently and first asked Spencer how the Nap Club got started and what the club is all about.
Well, I was talking to Mike here, and he wanted to get involved in the campus a little bit more. And I've been involved in various things here for a while, and he asked me for suggestions. He didn't really want to be part of student government, and so I suggested that he start a club. And he goes, well, what kind of club should I start? And I go, well, what do you like to do? And he said, sleep. We laughed about that a bit, and I said, well, start a sleeping club. Why don't you? And we just kind of joked with that for about a week or so. Then as the joking went on, we got more and more serious about this and realized the benefits that a nightclub could bring to the campus. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So one day, shortly after lunch, we just sat down, we wrote the Constitution, and then we went around to different professors, and we got Professor Olson, who's the head of sociology, to be our faculty advisor. We filled out the paperwork the next day, and we were a real club.
So is this what you expected, Mike?
It is what I expected. I didn't expect it to get nearly this big. I thought we'd just, you know, be a local campus, but it's taken off. We got an article in the school paper because they basically needed filler for a issue. So they said, you can do it on us. And South Bend Tribune saw it, and then the rest is just kind of went on from there.
So tell me the basics about the NAP Club, Mike. Do you have an official nap room? What do you guys do to facilitate napping?
We don't have an official room. The campus can't like reserve a room for the entire semester for us, so we have to reserve a room every week. And we just basically on Thursday or Friday, like, hey, we need a room for next week, and they give it to us. And what we do, we provide the people there with air mattresses that they can use, and we also wake them up on time, kind of like a wake-up service so they don't miss class.
Are there any rules to the NAP Club? Like, you know, Fight Club, with the first rule of NAP Club is you don't talk about NAP Club? I mean, what's the rules there?
First rule of NAP Club is you don't talk during NAP Club.
and that's about it.
As long as you're not disruptive to the other people, that's pretty much the only rule.
Now, Joe, what do people say to you and Mike when you tell them you have founded a club that is about napping?
They usually give a weird look at first, and then they kind of blow it off, and then I'm kind of like, well, no, it's a real club. This is what we do. And then people will, like, some people will give me, oh, napping is great. I heard such and such a little fact about napping. And a variety of comments, but I think most people think it's a great idea, especially the professors on campus. Love the idea of a nap club, and they tell their classes about it.
And what are your peak hours? And, you know, how many people join you during the course of the day?
It varies. We offer this from 11 to 3, Monday through Thursday. There's very few classes on Fridays. But basically anytime the people can get there, they're welcome to show up and just drop in. Usually we'll have about 2 or 3 people there at a time, and as people leave, more people come.
And it's just people napping. Nothing more than that.
Simple as that.
You mentioned earlier, Mike, that you guys have gotten a lot of press. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that people have caught on to this idea of what you guys are doing?
Because it's such a simple idea, and that like no one's really organized it before that well. I think this is just something novel that people have picked up.
You guys seem so busy now, because I've seen a lot of articles online about this and such. Have you guys had a chance to nap at all recently?
Not recently. We've been busy like calling people, sending emails and stuff, but it's, you know, we welcome the publicity.
Now, this nap club, it reminds me a lot of kindergarten. You know, when you're young, you'd play and then take a nap, and then you'd have juice and cookies. Now, is there a juice and cookie club in the works to compliment you? Or just nap?
Just nap. I think we're going to keep it at just the nap club. If another student wants to start the cookies and juice club, we'll think about doing some events together. I don't think we have any interest in starting another semi-related club. Yeah, we're keeping this free of charge for all the nappers. And if we started adding food and other things, we didn't have to charge.
Well, you guys have really hit on an idea here. Have you ever thought about franchising it? Have people talked to you about maybe doing this in other campuses around the country?
There's some people who are very interested on different like college campuses, so I assume that people will start forming them after they read the article in other campuses.
And this might be a business plan for you guys as well. You ever think about that, doing this maybe professionally as a new enterprise?
I don't think we've joked about it, but we know where that goes, but we don't know.
What's in the future for the Nap Club? What do you guys got planned in the near term?
Nothing definite, really. We kind of joke that we should have field trips to like a Sealy store or someplace where they make mattresses, as kind of joking, which could actually happen or possibly not, depending on what happens.
Well, you could get sponsorship from a mattress company.
We haven't right now. I think we're pretty set with everything that we think we need. We're going to have to upgrade our mattresses eventually. And we may be getting some club T-shirts to pass around.
So if anybody wants to learn more about what you guys do with the Nap Club, is there a place they can go? Is there a website?
Anybody can shoot us an email at iusbnapclub@gmail.com.
That was Joe Spencer and Michael Duttlinger, founders of the Nap Club at Indiana University, South Bend. This is Sidetrack. For his second feature film, Memphis-based writer-director Craig Brewer moved the cameras from seedy South Memphis to rural North Mississippi. His first movie, Hustle and Flow, earned the Audience Award at the 2005 Sundance Film Festival. The film also received 2 Oscar nominations last year and won the Academy Award for Best Original Song. Brewer's follow-up film is Black Snake Moan. It's about the relationship between a bluesman and a young woman, each of them needing their own kind of healing. The bluesman makes the young woman a prisoner in his home to cure her of her, quote, wickedness. Jeff Bossert recently visited Memphis and spoke with Brewer about the inspiration behind his latest effort.
Hustle and Flow originated because in South Memphis you saw this pimp hustling a white woman in this car.
Right, right.
Where does Black Snake Moan come from? Is there a seed there for this story?
Well, the seed really comes from me having really bad anxiety attacks when I was trying to get Hustle and Flow made. I was traveling constantly back and forth between Memphis and Los Angeles. I didn't have any money. I couldn't get a job because I was constantly being flown out there. Had to sleep on friends' couches and wasn't necessarily the best of environment for my marriage or for me to be a father. We just had a baby. So there was this flight I took and I experienced something that I'd never experienced. It was just this, my heart just started pounding really, really hard and I couldn't get any oxygen and it was terrible. I mean, it was like I thought I was having a heart attack. I called over the stewardess and I told her to get ready with the defibrillator that I was crashing. And she kind of squatted in the aisle next to me and said, I think you're having an anxiety attack, or what they call panic attack. And I was like, no, I don't panic. I don't get afraid to fly. I've flown all my life, but my father died of a heart attack at 49. So you need to get ready. And the more she started talking to me about the sensations that I was feeling, it began to pass. So I thought maybe I had some reaction to something, maybe ate something crazy. But then after that meeting and I was coming back, I got back on the plane and my mind just kept going, like, is that going to happen again? You know, that was so terrible. And the more I began obsessing about it, and once that pilot hit the throttle, I was awful. It was a terrible feeling. Like, I felt like I was on a roller coaster ride, but I was sitting still. And later I started talking to my wife about it, and she had been experiencing the same things on freeways. And so I decided I'd write about it a little bit. And I had this image in my head that was kind of helping me a little bit, that had come to me about me going through the front door of my granddad's house out in the woods in Rossville, Tennessee. And there was a radiator there, and there was this chain wrapped around it, and it was coiled down at the bottom, and it was like racing past me as if someone was running with the end of the chain, and it clanged up against the radiator. And once it clanged like that, it sounded almost like a church bell, just this bong, the feeling left me. And that's when I kind of got this idea that, well, maybe I can write this story that's about blues music, about anxiety music, fear music. And it didn't take too long for me to, change myself into a hot girl wearing Daisy Duke shorts and, a crop top.
Let's talk about the timing of this, when this script was completed, around the time that Hustle and Flow became a success, went to Sundance, winning awards. And when did this fall in line with that?
Well, see, that's what's kind of interesting. Like, I wrote Hustle and Flow, and then I wrote Black Snake Moan, thinking that Black Snake Moan would probably never get made. I mean, it's just such an outlandish scenario of this old black bluesman chaining up this white woman to cure her of this disorder that she had. And so after Hustle and Flow became this hit at Sundance, everybody in Hollywood wanted to know what I wanted to do next. And luckily I had a script. And even better, Singleton gave the script to Sam Jackson, and he was like, I got to do this movie. So every studio who had Hustle and Flow and passed on it because they were concerned about the subject matter now was waiting for me to do like a sequel or some sort of buddy movie. Here comes the script, Black Snake Moan. And they're like, oh Lord, like we just went through this, why are you pushing us? I gotta give credit where credit's due. And that's Brad Gray, who was running Paramount. He invited me up to his house and he said, if you want to make this movie, I want to support you as, I have other talented people and I want to support your talent, and, I'll support you in making this movie. So we were off and running with Black Snake Moan.
And that's a Blind Lemon Jefferson song.
It's what we named. I started to call this feeling Black Snake Moan. And it's the song by, as you put, Blind Lemon Jefferson, who, surprise, was blind. And he began singing about things in his room he couldn't see. He was singing about snakes and scorpions and bugs, and always wanting some pretty mama to come and get them and take them away. And that's how this feeling felt. It felt as if I didn't know when it was going to hit. I didn't know what triggered it. I didn't know what would really make it go away. And that's why I called it that. I know that many people read kind of like a sexual connotation into it, which is perfectly fine with me. The blues is all about spirituality and sexuality, and you can't do a movie about the blues without a fair amount of taboo.
So at the time you wrote it, it was probably way too early to envision big names in roles, because you hadn't achieved.
Oh no, success. No, I really thought that I'd be shooting it on video out in my granddad's house out in Rossville. I thought I'd probably get some old bluesman to play the character, and get a friend of mine in town, in Memphis, to play Ray, the hot girl. But things change, and suddenly Sam Jackson and Christina Ricci and Justin Timberlake are in my life, and now they're part of the movie.
One interview I read, you talked about taking Christina Ricci and Samuel L. Jackson out of their comfort zones.
Right.
Talk about their acceptance of these roles and, you know, why they were excited about doing the project.
Well, both of them really, really wanted to play these parts. And I think I understand why. Now, I mean, if you look at their body of work, they understand making iconic characters. They understand pushing their own abilities and really delivering on some stellar performances. And I know many people that think, you know, I say Samuel L. Jackson and Christina Ricci, and they kind of, you know, tilt their head like, you know, that's kind of an odd pair. But you see the movie, and there's something about her eyes, and there's something about his eyes, and their expressiveness that are so unique. I mean, you know, there is no other person like Samuel L. Jackson. There is no other woman like Christina Ricci. I said we needed a versus movie. You know, whoever was going to be Lazarus and whoever was going to be Ray, it had to be like Samuel L. Jackson versus Christina Ricci. It had to be two powerhouse performances that you wanted to see in combat with each other.
Found you out by the side of the road. Looked like somebody took the beating on you pretty bad. You know who done that to you?
Where's Ronnie?
I don't know who that is.
No, wait. He left. Well, I don't got any money or anything, you know, for fixing me up.
I don't need none.
I guess I best be on my way.
Well, I think we need to talk some.
No, sir. I gotta be on my way.
Best get your wits about you before you just start. I want to tell you about that.
Why you got me chained?
Talk about the role that blues music plays in this film and how themes from it are identified in those two characters.
Well, you know, I tell people when it comes to the music in my movies, it's not the frosting, it's the cake. I mean, I listen to music and roll around in my car driving to Memphis, and it really isn't until I start seeing some imagery in my head while I'm listening to music that I can start probing those images and finding a story. Half of my job is kind of this detective thing. Like, I'll see, like, that image with the radiator and the chain and just think, well, you know, what the hell's that about? I got to figure something out. I got to figure out what led up to this image or what happened after it. And that's where it all starts. So if you're talking about the blues, you know, you're talking about Taboo. But it was a music about fear and overcoming your fear. And I know historically, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, to some degree, young African-Americans have somewhat abandoned blues. It's not a music that they really embrace or study. And I can understand in a historical context why that's the case. I think that when the 60s came about, a lot of the African-American movement and civil rights was wanted to embrace a more empowering music. They did not want to go backwards. They didn't want to be singing about being tore down and almost level with the ground. You know, they wanted, you know, anthems of "We Shall Overcome." And no one really wanted to go backwards to that time. But the thing I try to remind everybody is, you know, these Delta bluesmen truly were pioneers, because you have to consider what they were singing about. Social injustice, you know, the injustice of nature, like, you know, Charlie Patton singing about levees breaking and entire towns being flooded, but also the injustice of the heart. And that could be as simple as "my woman's left me," or, you know, "God, I'm going to die. And I, you know, I don't want to go to hell." And they would articulate it over and over again in their verse. And each time they articulated it, there'd be more power behind it. And I can only believe that was a turning point for a lot of these bluesmen, where they began to take control of their fear instead of it controlling them. If you see my baby, they call her Alice.
Yeah! You hold on, man! You just walk through the door. Yeah!
If you see my baby, they call her Alice.
She took this movie to Sundance, and where you had this huge success 2 years ago. Was it like been there, done that, or did you go in with a little bit of swagger because you had achieved what dozens of filmmakers can only dream of?
Well, I mean, it's weird. You know, you make that first movie and you think to yourself that, you know, I've got to make it. Like, I've got to figure out some way to just make this one movie, and then I can retire and I can die and live a happy life. But then after that first movie came out and I had the option to make more, you begin to really think about a body of work. And you think, wow, you know, what are going to be the expectations that people want? It's not so much a matter of topping it, but defining yourself. And I think that when I went back to Sundance, I had so many people, so many festival goers come up to me and say, you know, we were there for Hustle. We can't wait to see Black Snake Moan. And it was really the first time I got to thank those people for my career, because they were the ones that voted at Best, you know, the Audience Award. They gave me my career to some extent. But, you know, 1,200 people giving a movie a standing ovation for Black Snake Moan is a pretty good way to come back to a festival. They really responded to it. They really loved it.
You thank the audience for changing your life. Have you had a chance to now and then stop and reflect Sundance 05 to the present, to you have another movie you're doing after this, to think about, you've been able to stay in Memphis by and large, but right. Talk about the life that you have now.
Well, it's definitely more complicated. It's more complicated, but to some extent, I'm trying to keep it simple. I live in Memphis. I have to occasionally go out to Los Angeles and work. I have an apartment out there, so if my family wants to come out with me, my son can have his own room and his own toys. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm working in the entertainment business now. I mean, I'm developing scripts. I'm a producer. I have a company on the Paramount lot. We're trying to come out with some more movies in addition to the movies that I make. But I got to say, you know, there was a time 10 years ago here in Memphis, Tennessee, where out of our, you know, crappy little house on the dead end of Vinton Avenue, we were building sets and making shorts and making features when nobody was telling us to do it. And there is many times we started questioning why we were doing that. And now that we're, you know, enjoying some level of success, that's the victory. The victory is we pushed ourselves when no one was pushing us and when no one was paying us. And now we're a part of this industry.
I climbed to the top of the tallest tree. The middle wind died down.
Middle wind died down.
I climbed to the top of the tallest tree. The middle wind died down.
That's music from the North Mississippi All-Stars, from the soundtrack to the new film Black Snake Moan. Jeff Bossert recently visited Memphis to talk with writer-director Craig Brewer. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.